Les colloques du Collège de France.
As you can see from my title slide, my talk this morning is about the clay envelopes enclosing juridical tablets that were discovered in the palace archives of Old Babylonian Alalakh. It's a real pleasure to speak about this particular topic at this particular colloquium, celebrating 140 years of research in Old Babylonian archival texts, because clay envelopes are a ubiquitous phenomenon encountered by all of us who work on Old Babylonian archives. As we all know, a juridical text did more than just document the licit transfer of property. The text functioned as title to the property as well. For this reason, it was important to keep the juridical text safe. In Babylonia, as in Assyria, during the first half of the second millennium, safeguarding the juridical text was typically done by encasing the tablet on which it was inscribed in a clay envelope on which the juridical text was rewritten and after which the surface of the envelope was sealed. Envelopes kept juridical text safe in at least two ways. One way was by providing the text on the tablet with a layer of protection in the event of damage. Indeed, our host, Dominique Charpin, has observed that in Babylonia, a tablet was typically inserted tetbesh in relation to the envelope in order to make it less likely that the same portion of text would be lost on both the envelope and the tablet if the pair was damaged. If I remove the words from my title slide, you may perhaps be able to make out this is exactly the manner in which this tablet from Old Babylonian Alalakh has been inserted into its envelope. Interestingly, this same practice was not consistently followed in contemporary Assyria. Envelopes also protected a juridical text by acting as proof against fraud. To my knowledge, one of the earliest explanations of how envelopes were used in this way was put forward in 1931 by Marion San Nicolo, and it goes something like this. Envelopes for juridical texts were a means of insuring against forgery, specifically in the form of altering an air-dried tablet by moistening, erasing, and reinscribing text. If fraud was alleged and the authenticity of the envelope's text was challenged, the text of the inner tablet would serve as verification. Cecile Michel has drawn attention to an old Assyrian text published by Faisal Donbaz, which demonstrates that the possibility of altering a sun-dried tablet in this way was real. In this text, a merchant instructs his associate that there is a tablet concerning a loan of 21 minas, 10 shekels of silver, and we are jointly responsible for the silver. Bring the tablet out, examine it, and moisten it with water where it states the silver is taken in the name of Ilish Tikal. As for the legal status of the Doppel Urkunde written on both tablet and envelope, in that 1931 essay I mentioned a moment ago, San Nicolo also raised the interesting possibility that perhaps it was the envelope that functioned as the authenticator text, with the tablet as only a means of verification, because it was the envelope, not the tablet, that was sealed. The use of a tablet for verification, though not in a case of suspected fraud, is documented by a record of court proceedings from Sipar, edited by our host Dominique, which concerns a real estate transaction that occurred over 50 years before. After the litigants came before the judges inspected the matter, but the envelope of the tablet was broken, so they removed her, that is, the defendant's tablet, and they confirmed her ownership of the 5-6 Sar, 6 Gin plot, according to her old tablet, that is, the original purchase contract. As for the process by which a tablet was encased in an envelope, it is still possible to encounter citations of Edward Kerr's programmatic statement that it is impossible to put an envelope around an already dry tablet since the envelope would begin to shrink and could not do so because the tablet inside was already dry and hard, it would have to crack. However, in a study of old Assyrian envelopes, Cecile Michel has shown that envelopes were routinely put around both wet and dry tablets. A wet tablet could be wrapped in a textile to prevent it from adhering to the clay of the envelope. It has been suggested that traces of white powder that have been observed in old Assyrian envelope fragments may, quote, correspond to decomposed textile fibers. On the other hand, many envelope fragments have the impression of cuneiform signs on their inner surface, and these impressions seem to derive from the latter situation in which an envelope was put around a tablet that was already dry. Finally, and this is the aspect of tablets and envelopes that I am particularly interested in today, there is the question of textual variance that one invariably finds in the two versions of the same juridical text that was inscribed on both the tablet and the envelope. For instance, one of our participants at this colloquium who could not be here, Stephen Moore, just published a fascinating juridical text from Sipar concerning the repayment of a ransom, complete with these beautiful photographs of the tablet and its envelope. When I was reading this article, I couldn't resist highlighting the textual variance between the tablet and the envelope. As you can see here, in the 21 lines of duplicate text that are preserved between the two, there are 13 variants, including different orthography, transpositions, and additions to the text. Now, this situation is very typical and familiar to all of us who have worked with tablets and envelopes. But how do we account for these differences between the two versions of the text? Are they simply the result of hectic working conditions, reflecting, say, a harried scribe who wrote the tablet and envelope at a crowded city gate? Or if the envelopes were put around tablets when the latter was already dry, is it just the temporal distance between the production of these two duplicate texts that accounts for textual variation? Or is there some other explanation altogether? Of course, knowing how, when, and where a text was inscribed onto an envelope relative to tablet could help explain why this textual variation occurs. However, in the absence of this information, could the opposite be true? Could studying the distribution and pattern of textual variants help us reconstruct the circumstances of textual production? This second possibility is the one I want to explore with you today, focusing on the clay envelopes from Old Babylonian Alalakh in particular. Before jumping into my investigation proper, then, I want to briefly introduce you to the site, its texts, and in particular, its envelopes. The city of Alalakh, modern Tel Adshana, is located near the great bend of the Orontes River in the Amuk Valley of what is now the Republic of Turkey's Hatay province. The city was inhabited for most of the second millennium BC, during which time it often acknowledged the hegemony of other larger powers. Most important for our purposes today is the stratigraphic level known as 7, which dates to the late Old Babylonian period, and in which the site's excavator, Sir Leonard Woolley, uncovered a palace that contained several hundred cuneiform texts. These tablets are primarily legal and administrative texts that concern the ruling family's property. They establish that the rulers of Old Babylonian Alalakh were a cadet line of the royal family of Yamkhad, and they document the activities of this branch of the family over the reigns of at least 7 kings of Yamkhad, beginning some decades after the fall of Mari. Indeed, Dominique Cologne, who is the only scholar I know to have attempted to provide a historical explanation for the juridical tablets and envelopes at Alalakh, located her explanation precisely in the subordinate relationship of the rulers of Alalakh to the kings of Yamkhad. She posited a scenario in which legal contracts which needed royal approval were drawn up in Alalakh, and the interested parties would take the tablet to Halab, where the envelope would be placed around the tablet and sealed by the creditor, if any, by local dignitaries from Alalakh, and probably from Halab, and by the king. According to Cologne's hypothesis, then, some variance between the text on the envelope and tablet should be only a byproduct of the temporal distance between the composition of the two, but others were more meaningful. In particular, the additional witnesses who can appear in the text of an envelope but not its tablet would be the dignitaries from Halab who were only present the second time that the text was written, when it was reproduced on the envelope. Unfortunately, this hypothesis has not held up under scrutiny. Intrigued by its explanatory potential, several years ago I studied which sorts of legal transactions fell under the jurisdiction of the kings of Yamkhad and which fell under local Alalakhian jurisdiction. For instance, I was able to conclude that court proceedings fell under the jurisdiction of the kings of Yamkhad, while loans fell under local jurisdiction. The catch is that even legal transactions under local jurisdiction were provided with envelopes, counter to Cologne's hypothesis according to which these transactions should not have been because they did not require authorization in Aleppo. At this point, let us look a little more closely at the corpus of clay envelopes from Old Babylonian Alalakh. I won't go into too much detail about the publication history of the envelopes, except to say that at this point, there are 11 published envelopes that can be associated with tablets, which you see here in Manfred Dietrich and Oswald Loretz's hand copies. These two scholars have also published another 11 envelopes that they could not associate with any tablets. Therefore, the data set of published envelopes from Old Babylonian Alalakh currently stands at 22, of which the 11 shown in this slide can be associated with published tablets. Obviously, if we are interested in the question of textual variation between tablets and their envelopes, it is only these 11 that we can study. And so these 11 envelopes and their associated tablets comprise my data set for this paper, my duplicate texts, if you will. Before I get into my analysis of these 11 duplicate texts, however, I want to emphasize its preliminary nature. Obviously, 11 texts do not make for a large corpus, and it is hard to know how representative it is. Just as importantly, though, my results must also be considered preliminary because, despite the work of Cologne and Dietrich and Loretz, there are still many envelope fragments that remain unpublished. In 2002, I had my own opportunity to survey the Old Hatay Archaeological Museum's cuneiform storerooms, and I can confirm that there are many unpublished envelope fragments. Here are just a few boxes. I'd be happy to say a bit more about these unpublished fragments during the question period at the end of my talk, but for now I want you to understand why any analysis of the published envelope fragments can only be considered preliminary. Nonetheless, I do think that we get some very interesting results from the data that are already available, and these results can be the basis for future research questions. So now, on to the preliminary analysis. The main focus of my analysis has been on the different types of variants that appear and the relative frequency of these different types, but before discussing those results, I do want to say a few words about some general trends in variation when we approach the corpus by text. Overall, the 11 envelopes associated with published tablets result in a data set of 198 lines of duplicate text. Across these 198 lines, I have documented 63 distinct variants, which works out to one variant every 3.14 lines. Significantly, there is a very great difference in the number of variants found at any given envelope. Briefly, here is the same table, now sorted by variants per line, lowest to highest. To some extent, this difference is a product of the number of duplicate lines that are preserved. For instance, it is perhaps not a surprise that an envelope that preserves only four lines of text contains no variants. But the envelope with the next fewest variants is quite noteworthy. This envelope has only one variant every 12 lines, yet it is also the envelope preserving the greatest number of duplicate lines. Meanwhile, at the bottom of the table is an envelope that preserves less than half as much text, yet has four times the number of variants, at a rate of almost one variant per line. Why is there such a discrepancy in the relative frequency of variants by envelope? Let us look at what type of legal transaction each envelope documents. Briefly, the corpus consists of five records of court proceedings, which I'm highlighting here in red, three purchases of a movable property, highlighted in blue, and three loans, highlighted in green. In order to try and make this rainbow of a table a little more comprehensible, I'm now going to display the same information to you as a bar graph, and I'm also going to suggest that we omit any discussion of purchases of a movable property, because one of the relevant envelopes preserves only four lines of text, while the other two examples are extremely interesting but require some qualification. I'll come back to them at the end of my talk, but in the meantime, let us look at a bar graph that shows the relative frequency of variants in just records of court proceedings and loans. The five records of court proceedings are on the left and the three loans are on the right. Although there are differences even among the texts of a particular type of legal transaction, we can perhaps make out a general tendency in this graph, namely that records of court proceedings tend to have fewer variants per line than loans. But why might the relative frequency of variation between envelope and tablet correlate to whether the juridical text is the record of a court proceeding or a loan? Here are three possible answers to this question. One possible answer is, of course, that the discrepancy reflects something intrinsic to the act of recording each type of legal event. In other words, that there was something about how litigation and indebtedness were recorded that resulted in less or more variation between tablet and envelope. For instance, perhaps the records of court proceedings were written in the solemnity of a court chancellery, while loans were written at a busy city gate. A second related possibility goes back to differences in legal jurisdiction that I mentioned earlier. Because court proceedings almost always fell under the jurisdiction of the King of Yamhad, while loans were transacted under local jurisdiction at Alalakh, the difference in frequency of variance between the two types of legal transactions could reflect the different jurisdictions. Perhaps the scribes attached to the court of Aleppo were better trained than the local scribes, and so less likely to introduce variance into the text. A third possible explanation is that the discrepancy in the frequency of variance between the two transactions actually reflects diachronic change. Records of court proceedings are records of unlimited validity that were handed down from generation to generation as long as the property under litigation remained in a family member's hands. However, loans were records of limited validity that were normally broken or otherwise discarded when the loan was repaid in the months or years after the document was drawn up. Sure enough, the surviving records of court proceedings in the red boxes are among the older juridical texts in the palace archive, while on the other hand, the surviving loans in the green boxes are among the most recent. If the frequency of variance between envelopes and tablets had nothing to do with the type of text, but simply increased over time, we would see that change reflected in our documentation as a higher frequency of variance in loans than records of court proceedings. However, if we go back to this graph, it must be admitted that we see a terrific difference in the relative frequency of variance even among the three examples of loans. Therefore, it may be that any impression of a tendency of relative frequency to cluster by legal transaction is just a distortion produced by the very small sample size being studied. For this reason, I suggest that we consider difference in variant frequency by legal transaction to be a hypothesis still requiring future testing, and move on instead to what I mentioned earlier has been the real focus of my analysis, the different types of variants that appear in the duplicate texts. The six types of variants that occur between envelope and tablet are familiar to all of us. There are additions, whereby some text on the envelope does not appear on the tablet. For instance, where one tablet lists a certain Ekhli Ishtar as a witness, its envelope qualifies him as a Shangu priest of Ishtar. Next, we have elisions, whereby some text on the tablet does not appear on the envelope. For instance, in this text, two brothers and their mother purchase a piece of immovable property. On the tablet, the purchasers are qualified as the sons of Urpa Adu. But this patronymic is omitted on the envelope, which proceeds directly from naming the purchasers to specifying the purchase price. We find transpositions, whereby some text appears in a different sequence on the envelope than it does on the tablet. For instance, in this record of court proceedings, two individuals, together with their qualifications, are listed in different order on the envelope than on the tablet. The fourth type of variant is substitutions, whereby some text on the envelope substitutes for other text on the tablet. My particular favorite variant in the entire corpus is this envelope that substitutes a Kalu palace for the tablet's Sharu king in the stipulation, apart from the king, no one else will support the debtors. The fifth is orthographic variants, whereby some text on the envelope is written differently than on the tablet. For instance, in this envelope, in the protasis of the penalty clause, whoever will return and raise a claim, the final radical of the verb ituruma, return, is explicitly doubled on the envelope, but not on the tablet. And finally, there are scribal errors in which the variant text on the envelope is not sensible and so can safely be considered an error. For instance, the omission on the envelope of the sign du in the personal name Lockheed Saduk results in a personal name that is not sensible and almost certainly not an abbreviation. How common, then, are these different types in the corpus of 63 variants across 198 lines of duplicate text? Additions, which are all the way on the left, in this graph are by far the most frequent type of variant, comprising 35 out of 63 examples, or more than one half of the total. After additions, elisions, and orthographic variants are the two most common, but at 20% and 11% of the total, they are far less frequent than additions. Transpositions, substitutions, and scribal errors are relatively rare. Let us look a little more closely now at that most frequent type of variant, additions, and specifically at what is being added. The distribution is, again, overwhelmingly one-sided. The most frequent subtype, all the way on the left, and comprising more than half of all additions, 18 out of 35 examples, is the addition of a witness who is not present on the tablet. In other words, more than half of all the additions occur after the record of the legal event on the juridical text. And this tendency is even more pronounced if we look at the next two most frequent types of additions, the addition of a profession after someone's name and the addition of a date. Both of these also occur either in the witness list or just after it. The end of a juridical text after the record of the legal event is clearly the prime location for additions to the duplicate text, supplying almost 75%, that is three quarters of all examples of this most common type of variant. Why might this be? One very tentative suggestion is that the scribes are taking advantage of extra space on the envelope. Because it surrounds the tablet, an envelope by definition will always be larger than its tablet and therefore have more surface area that can potentially be inscribed with text. To be sure, the greater available surface area is somewhat diminished by the large strip of clay running along the envelope's left side that was left blank for seal impressions, but this practice does not seem to have actually taken away too much space because line breaks on tablets and envelopes tend to be the same. And when we consider, as you can see in this slide, that the bottom and top edges of an envelope can be inscribed with four or five lines of text, whereas the corresponding edges of the tablet can be inscribed with only one or two, it becomes clear that envelopes could be inscribed with considerably more text than the tablet they encased. Recognizing this fact may help explain what we are seeing in this slide. Scribes may have omitted some witnesses from the tablet, always intending to include them on the envelope. Or scribes may have chosen not to inscribe the date formula on a tablet, confident in the knowledge that they would have sufficient room to add the date in the extra space afforded by the envelope's top edge. Indeed, this realization may give us a new perspective on the other additions that we do encounter in the record of the actual legal event. Except for a single uncertain addition, all of these, from the inclusion of a unit of measurement after a number to the specification of an accusative pronominal suffix on a verb, these additions add clarification to the juridical text that was written earlier on the tablet. Let us look briefly at the second most frequent type of variant, elisions, to see if and how it complements this picture. With a total of only 11 variants of this type, the data are too few to be conclusive, but again, we see that witnesses are the most frequent type of elision. While elisions by their very nature would seem to complicate our sense that the extra space on envelopes was an important factor behind the textual variation between tablet and envelope, if nothing else, this distribution confirms the impression that we took away from our look at the types of additions, namely that the end of the text after the record of the legal event is the primary place for variation between tablet and envelope. and other instances of elisions actually do serve to clarify the text. For example, let us look at one of the two instances where a patronymic has been elided from the text on an envelope. You may remember this slide as my example of an elision from when I was going through the typology of variants. This particular text records the purchase of a movable property in which the sellers are two brothers and a mother. On the tablet, these three sellers are named successively in lines 3 through 5 and then qualified in line 6 as the sons of Urpa Adu. However, as you can see in the slide, the patronymic has been elided from the text on the envelope. Why? Perhaps to clarify it, since if sons is being used in the biological sense, the patronymic inadvertently includes Urpa Adu's wife as one of his sons, as it appears on the tablet. One implication, I think, of this preliminary analysis to challenge our notion about which object, the tablet or the envelope, is inscribed with the authentic text and which is the duplicate, as San Niccolo already considered almost 100 years ago. Indeed, I wonder whether the tablet might even have been a first draft of sorts that was written before a legal transaction took place and then was repurposed and kept for security reasons. While this idea is just speculation, as my last point this morning, I want to look a little more closely at the juridical text on this slide and suggest to you that its particular envelope fragments did have some sort of intrinsic value to the archive owner. The leftmost image in this slide shows you Dietrich and Loretz's hand copy of the tablet, which is a contract for the purchase of possibly a house. The other hand copies on the slide are of envelope fragments for this tablet that seem to be two distinct envelopes that are inscribed with the same text. That is, although both envelopes are somewhat fragmentary, enough text overlaps between the two, as indicated here in red, to establish not just that they seem to be duplicates of the same text, but also that they cannot be fragments of the same envelope. Apart from the other details that the text on the envelopes have in common, the penalty clause for this particular juridical text specifies a payment of silver to the Temple of Ishtar instead of the Temple of Adu in the palace. This penalty clause is unique in the level 7 corpus, so it is extremely striking to find it preserved on both envelopes. Unfortunately, the archaeological records for the tablet and envelope fragments are not as helpful as one might hope. This slide shows you the relevant field cards from Woolley's excavations. The card on the left gives dimensions and reads, tablet written on both sides, top and edge chipped, 39 Palace, room 11. The one on the right reads, fragments of envelopes, some with seal impressions, 39 Palace, room 11. The field cards establish then that the tablet and envelope fragments were found in the same room, which contained one of the palace's main archives. Furthermore, we can infer that the envelope fragments did not encase the tablet at the time of their discovery because other field cards do explicitly state when this occurs. However, we cannot infer that the tablet and envelope fragments were found or stored apart from each other from the fact that they have different excavation numbers. It is clear that the palace archives were badly disturbed shortly before the palace's destruction, and the tablet and envelope fragments could have been separated at that time. Perhaps it can be established that one of the envelopes originally encased a different tablet inscribed with a related transaction, maybe one that entered the archives as a retroact, so that the possibility of one tablet with two envelopes can be explained away. But at present, it also seems possible that at some point, the envelope for this particular tablet broke, or was broken, in order to resolve a legal challenge, and subsequently a new envelope for the tablet was created and inscribed, while at the same time, the fragments of the first envelope were stored. To wrap up our look at the envelopes inscribed with juridical texts at Old Babylonian Alalakh, my preliminary analysis has shown that, at Alalakh at least, the majority of textual variants are additions to the envelope that occur at the end of the text after the record of the legal event. Other additions, and even some elisions, may have had the purpose of clarifying the record of the legal event itself. When these two features are combined with what seemed to be the existence in the palace archives of two distinct envelopes for a single juridical text, we may find support at Old Babylonian Alalakh for Marion San Nicolo's suggestion that it was the envelope, not the tablet, which was the actual legal instrument. An analysis of the unpublished fragments, I hasten to emphasize first that this picture is based on only the small amount of published data, and analysis of the unpublished fragments may change it. And second, that my support for San Nicolo's suggestion is restricted to the use of envelopes at Old Babylonian Alalakh. In this regard, I would be very interested to hear from this audience of specialists in Old Babylonian archival texts any thoughts as to the similarities and differences with the envelopes from the different sites that you have worked with. And here I will conclude my remarks this morning, only making sure first to thank you for your attention.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.